If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
There's a gap in the general historical understanding of what happened in the sort of central lands of Islam, which has led to a perception of Muslims and Islam in general as being impervious to change and resistant to modernization.
That was Christopher de Belaigue on common misconceptions about Islamic culture and the history of the Middle East.
Listening to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine. We're the UK's best-selling history magazine, available in print and several digital formats all over the world. Find out more at historyextra.com/subscribe or look out for us in your digital newsstand or app store.
Hello and welcome to our fourth podcast of April 2017. I'm Rob Attar, the editor of BBC History Magazine. This week's episode is a world history special to accompany our new bi-monthly magazine, BBC World Histories. Our interviewee is the journalist and author Christopher de Belaigue, whose latest book is The Islamic Enlightenment, The Modern Struggle Between Faith and Reason, which explores the question of how the Muslim world has adapted to wider changes taking place in the 19th and 20th centuries. Putting the questions to him was the journalist and author Yasmin Alibi Brown.
I wonder if you can just give me your pitch. You can't summarise such a book, but what is the main argument, if you like, that you're making here?
Well, if I start with the premise and then move on to the argument, I'd say that the premise is that there's a gap in the general historical understanding of what happened in the sort of central lands of Islam, which has led to a perception of Muslims and Islam in general as being impervious to change and resistant to modernization, full stop. And if you look, generally the counter-argument is taken back to Baghdad in the 9th and 10th centuries and the wonderful efflorescence of Islamic culture and the contribution that Islamic culture made to world culture at that time. But if you put that to one side, people say, well, what happened after that? We don't see any much evidence for a kind of progressive and pro-change agenda in the Muslim world. If you look at the central lands of Islam in the 19th and early 20th century, as I do in this book, you find, on the contrary, a very vital and real engagement with modern ideas, modern technologies, modern conundrums, that really belies that whole image. And you find people engaging sometimes with difficulty, sometimes with perplexity, but sometimes very joyfully with ideas and technologies that they consider to be universal and not simply something that has been foisted on them or imported from the West.
But there were instances earlier. I mean, there was the Golden Age, then there was the Imperial Age, and I think a lot of this happened during the Imperial Age. But there were also, I think, quite a lot of examples, weren't there, when you mentioned the Robert Shirley, who went to the Persian court, the immense respect, because what they found there really enthralled them, or the playwrights who wrote about the Mughal courts. and Lady Mary Montagu Wortley, who went to Istanbul in the 17th century and was amazed by the culture and the innovation, because the vaccination thing, because I was reminded of her. In your book, you talk about somebody whose grandson or son died of smallpox. Way, way back, they were using for smallpox vaccination. So there were people in the West, particularly in England, I think, who had this understanding that the Muslims were very innovative. But the period you're handling is the most problematic in a way, isn't it? And because so much of these free thinkers, scientists and rational people who, most of them did manage to live within their faith and still have this side, were considered suspects, part of the colonial brainwashing mission, if you like.
I think that's right. And I think you're right to bring up the earlier instances of fruitful cooperation and indeed admiration going both ways. I was struck the other day reading letters that Voltaire had written. And Voltaire is famous for having supported Catherine the Great in her incursions against Ottoman Turkey. However, in other areas, particularly his treatise on tolerance, which came up, bubbled up, as a result of a major international incident where a Protestant family had been persecuted by Catholic France, he referred directly to the court at Istanbul as being a place that, by comparison, was a beacon of tolerance. The Shirley brothers you mention in Iran, a great sense of respect. Shakespeare mentions with respect in many instances the Islamic world. So it's not a uniform picture, of course. When you get to the 19th century, I think there's an acceleration of history. There's an acceleration of contact that makes processing all the things that are coming in and all the things that are going out much, much more fraught and much harder. And as you say, those who are trying to bring in ideas, particularly those who've been to the West, were always vulnerable to the charge that they were furthering a sinister agenda of colonial exploitation. Because at the end of the Napoleonic Wars and the invasion of Egypt in 1798 was very much part of a much broader strategy by Napoleon to, if possible, go all the way to India. And that colonial agenda then went forward in the 19th century. However, it didn't go forward to such an extent that these joyful and interesting contacts were cut off. And I think that is an important point in my story, because I feel that there's another cutoff point after which it became much, much harder to bring in
World
ideas.
World War One. We'll go to that in a minute. But I'm really interested in this character. I was completely taken with him. Rifa
Tahtawi.
Yeah. Will you tell us a bit more about that?
Well, Rifa Tahtawi was an Egyptian cleric. He fulfilled the role of a chaplain to the army of Muhammad Ali, who was the first great authoritarian moderniser of the Middle East after the end of the Napoleonic invasion in the early stages of the 19th century. And he came from a tradition of clerical authority. And under that tradition, the clerics had exercised enormous authority, partly because of their monopoly over knowledge and the written word. What Muhammad Ali did was to send educational missions to Europe, in this case to France. Quite a large one went. And Rifa went along with that mission. There were many other boys of different origins going from Egypt. There were Armenians, there were Circassians, there were Arabs, there were Turks, all on this mission. And Rifa went along and he produced a travelogue at the end of this time, which was a kind of summation of his view of what he'd seen. And he came away with a very vivid admiration for a great deal about France that was completely unencumbered by a sense of inferiority or a sense of resentfulness, because he saw these values as something that Egypt could learn from and could also grow with. And he became one of the, in some ways, one of the founding fathers of the modern Egyptian nation state, but not in a prickly and xenophobic form, because in his history writing, he went all the way back to pre-Islamic Egypt, and he acknowledged the debt that Egyptian culture owed to other cultures. It was a remarkable sort of synthesis in his mind.
He's an amazing character. I knew nothing about him. But of course...
Well, if I may say so, if you don't know anything about him, imagine what the majority...
I mean, there's so much here.
The characters in this book are... lamentably ill-known, and yet they had, formative influence.
You start the book with Jane Eyre, which I think is a very lovely way to start, but also to make people understand that actually humans are more alike than we like to think. But then you come to this Turkish woman. Would you tell her, again, totally unknown by me, and I'm fascinated.
Well, I bring in Fatma Ali quite early on because... it's part of a section of the book where I stand up the character of Jane Eyre, set in roughly around 1820, operating autonomously, using modern technologies, taking her own decisions, working as a teacher, changing her situation without recourse to a father or any other kind of male figure for permission, falling in love with the person she wants to, and all the rest of it. And I asked the question, well, what was the situation in the Islamic world at that time? Would a Jane Eyre character have been feasible? And I quickly come to the conclusion that it would have been unfeasible. However, by the end of the century... some 50 years later, you have a character like Fatma Ali, who was brought up, I think, in common with many other of the early feminists around the world. She was upper class. She was given an education. She had the opportunity to learn French, although she had to do so in secret because her mother considered French to be a kind of Trojan horse for all sorts of infidel and impious thoughts. So she learned French. She started to use the nascent medium of the press to get her ideas out. This was a world in the Ottoman heyday when the steamer was entering, the telegraph was entering, the press was entering, table manners were entering. You know, all sorts of things were coming into Istanbul and churning.
So when are we talking about now?
We're talking the 1870s and 1880s and 1890s were really her heyday. She started to... she wrote novels. She wrote... she contributed to the press. To begin with, women would contribute to the press as an Ottoman lady or... a person with long black hair, or they would use these little
pseudonyms like they had here.
Exactly as they had here. And then gradually they got bolder and their demands grew bolder. And Fatma Ali was an early proponent of what later became a major sort of movement among Ottoman and Iranian women and Egyptian women to express all sorts of desires and thoughts and perplexities that had never been publicly debated before, that the nature of female society was of segregation. It was discussing all these things behind closed doors, whether it was in the hammam or whether it was behind the lattice work of an upper class house. It was all discussed closed doors, and suddenly you're addressing a body of opinion that you don't know. They may be your articles may be translated and suddenly discussed in Alexandria or Beirut. And so this process of the acceleration of the transfer of ideas just comes into play.
And this is modernization. This was the modernity coming and being grasped. And what was interesting, what is interesting in what you say is they didn't see it as a threat to Islamic civilization. They saw quite a lot of it as enrichment. And I was very struck by what you were saying about the dilemma over dissection, for example. I mean, they knew they had to get the scientific knowledge, but there were these things about you can't undo what God's done. And I'm so interested because we are living in times again, because that happened, I think, during the, as you say, after the First World War, this idea that of them and us and any cultural or scientific or borrowings weaken us or take away our usness. And that is growing, isn't it, across the Islamic world?
I think the sense of usness is... it's the first time I've heard that phrase, and I think it's a fabulous phrase, because what it means is the word authenticity is so much more boring. Usness is very good. What constitutes us, and what is threatening our usness? I think it is not only present in the West, but it's being answered in the Islamic world. It's being answered in Modi's India. It's a spreading movement of reaction to globalization or the erosion of usness. In the Islamic world, something like dissection was clearly, you had to move on from the Galenic theoretical approach or the Avicenna's approach and start examining the human body under laboratory conditions. But how do you do that when the prophet says you mustn't? Well, you need someone in a religious position to justify that. And that is what gradually happened.
The one thing that I think is really important for readers to understand when they read the book is how colonialism, and it's at its most ugliest, both French and particularly British colonialism with Cromer and so on, kind of made it impossible for the enlightened Muslims to flourish because they could so easily be accused, as they were, the feminist writers, the scientists, of being stooges, of being tools of empire, of having been educated in the West and therefore not being properly Muslim or Arab. And that, is a very important thing to point out, isn't it? That how colonialism interfered with what was a very good process.
The process is clearly something that has universal appeal, but if it's being propagated by a machine which is at the same time a machine of domination, political domination and economic domination, then obviously it becomes extremely easy to call anyone involved with that process stooges. So you see, and I write about it in the book, you see a lot of careers damaged, a lot of hopeful beginnings ended, a lot of fine minds cut off because of this easily leveled accusation. Sure. of being a stooge. The Grand Mufti of Cairo at the beginning of the 20th century, Muhammad Abdu, was not only a very fine and respected theologian. He was also someone who corresponded with Tolstoy, who came to England and visited Herbert Spencer, who visited, who took the waters in Switzerland. He was extremely cosmopolitan, and he exemplified that whole approach. As a result, and because Britain was running Egypt at the time, and Lord Cromer, who was essentially the viceroy in Egypt at the time, favoured Abdu, his position was rendered completely untenable. And so when he started bringing in very forward and innovative new fatwas about what was permissible and what was illicit for Muslims, it was easy. He was easily shut out, and he was shut out, and his career was destroyed.
In the book, you say that's what was the great, if you like, the great break from, you know, the kind of almost unplanned, informal, natural, holistic cultural exchanges and modernization that was taking place. Then comes the dreadful First World War, dreadful for everybody, all sides. What happens?
Before the First World War, there was what we could call a liberal moment in the Middle East. Turkey and Iran had both had revolutions that brought in and established a form of parliamentary democracy that clearly had a very strong liberal component, was interested in broadening the franchise, in limiting the powers of the crowned head. Egypt had had a similar revolution that had only really been thwarted by British invasion in 1882. But there was a strong sense that the direction of society was going towards a liberal interpretation of freedoms, political and personal autonomy. The First World War obliterated the physical geography. It left behind, I mean, you know, the mobility that you find in the armies in the Middle East in the First World War contrasted so very strongly with the immobility of the armies in on the Western Front. Whole areas, you know, thousands of miles were crossed, crops were destroyed, famines were induced, borders were treated with absolute impunity. And what you ended was a kind of tabula rasa with Britain and France essentially creating new states. Egypt remained under British supervision. Iran and Turkey could only avoid subjugation, as they saw it, by instituting a very illiberal form of westernization that drew from Mussolini's example. Not that they were wrong to do so, but it had unfortunate effects. And then what we find as a result is, I think, two strands broadly of opinion rising in the Middle East. The first is that authoritarian westernization, and the second is Islamism, what we now consider to be the progenitors of the worst forms of Islamism that we see around today. And they started, the Muslim Brotherhood did not start as a political movement. It started as a movement of self-realization, of patriotism, and above all, of let's get the Brits out. And this is how it was essentially to give self-respect back to Muslims, not by aping Lord Cromer and the British administrators, but by a return to the roots. And so this is how the process began. And then it evolved and it developed new forms, because even after independence in the Middle East, the Western penetration, the Western interventions did not cease. Where there were positive and very benign forms of exploration towards self-government, for example, Mohammad Mossadegh in Iran in the early 1950s, a patriotic nationalist but not at all anti-Western prime minister, demanding that the oil industry be nationalized and demanding a relationship of equality with the West, then that was too much for the West, particularly Britain and America, to swallow. And so he was toppled. And each time these interventions, whether it was Suez, whether it was Mossadegh, or whether it was simply a British ambassador or an American ambassador telling the prime minister of the day what needed to happen, it added to that sense that the only way to escape this was to return to some kind of usness, to some kind of authenticity. And often what was found was a complete distortion of that original usness. It was a very modern version, sometimes anarchic, sometimes violent, sometimes tearing up the original Islamic texts over what constitutes justified violence and completely rewriting them, but under the guise of a kind of stronger, more virile, more nationalist form of Islam.
And so you could say, couldn't you, that the kind of the ISIS or Al-Qaeda phenomena came from exactly that source of the West is interfering in our matters, and therefore the only way to confront them is to go back to roots. And of course, each generation is defining those roots in increasingly repressive ways. But at the same time, for me personally, as somebody who grew up in the empire, it's deeply unfortunate that a valid political struggle against domination got religiousized and therefore became emotional and became kind of took over rationality. You know, I regret that we didn't have an anti-colonial, and you see this in Palestine now. The Palestinian struggle was never one to do with religion. It was a political struggle. Their best voices were Christian, for God's sake, Edward Said, Hanan al-Ashrawi. Now it's religiousized. And exactly the same thing with the anti-colonial struggles. Because of the Brotherhood and others, Qutb, wasn't he? He was the kind of... They kind of manipulated the religious feeling among Muslims and manipulated and exploited them. And I find that really problematic.
I think you're right, and I think that a very interesting angle is to look at the blurring of the divide between the political and the cultural, because what is ultimately a legitimate campaign for self-determination, whether as a community or as an individual human being, becomes infused with something that is extremely xenophobic, that rejects difference, whatever its source, and that infects the cultural sphere, that really does an injustice, dishonors the whole idea of the transferability of values, the transferability of sensual, of the senses almost, of all the manifestations of culture that one can enjoy in this world, suddenly get boiled down and reduced to something so, so limited that the whole range of human experience becomes, it becomes black and white instead of being full of colour and full of vibrancy. And this is what we find, that the closing down of cultural avenues for different reasons across the Middle East, or a kind of return to a spurious kind of authenticity, wherever it happens, is really a return to a black and white, a monochrome world.
And you're so right about spurious authenticity, because I often have had quarrels with Egyptians, Saudi Arabians, you know, saying, oh, we're going back to the Prophet's time. I say, why have you got a mobile phone in your hand? Do you have a computer? Do you drive a car? You're not driving around camels. So where is this thing we're going to live, you know, going to have the beard, but you still have a phone? So it is completely spurious, but it has this appeal of, and yeah, in a way you might say, give us back our country in Britain, is about yearning for some kind of pure white authenticity, I don't know, going back when, and so on. Are you hopeful that these three places that you've done most work on, Cairo, Tehran and
Istanbul,
will reach a point where they will have to turn back towards, you know, the places they once were?
I think that history shows the constant tug and the constant ebb and flow of the ideas that I discuss in the book. There will always be rebuffs, and I think it takes time for rebuffs to be accommodated, absorbed, and eventually overturned. I'm not sure that I believe anymore in a predetermined trajectory of history. However, what I do believe in is the constant opposition, the constant and often very fruitful opposition of different ideas. And if you can set up one idea as looking towards the future, optimism, hopefulness, and you set up another idea of conservatism, fear, then in many ways these feelings and sentiments exist in all of us, and as a result they exist in all societies. And just as we in our personal lives as human individuals have to negotiate with them every day, so do societies, and they will do. I'm not hopeful in the very short term, but in the long term I expect to see within my lifetime a resurgence of the ideas that we speak about. I don't think that resurgence will necessarily take us back to where we were. It will take us to some new form, and there will always be a kind of intermingling of the two, because as I say, I don't think that one is really possible without the other. It's a necessary dialectic of human existence.
Coming back to now, then, we are, you know, as you said, from wherever you look, modernism is being rejected, liberalism, cross-culturalism, cosmopolitanism. What is going to need to happen? Can there be stuff that can be done to move us back into what has been the most fruitful thing for the human race, is this exchange?
What has happened cannot be undone, and some appalling things have been done that meant that we are where we are. We have to start by looking at civilizations and cultures as operated upon by human beings. They are human operations. There is nothing determined in advance. So we have to look at the invasion of Iraq and to a lesser extent of Afghanistan and regard them as absolutely defining events in modern Middle Eastern history that are going to be felt for a very long time. So you start by thinking you need to avoid that kind of involvement in the future. But there will always be calls and appeals, sometimes from within the countries themselves, that in fact you're turning a blind eye to something appalling, to appalling events that are happening inside. My feeling is that we need to avoid that kind of adventure in the past, no matter how, in the short term, no matter how compelling a moral argument could be made in its favour. I think that's what we need to do on the political level. We are also finding that, and we have been finding this for some time now, that what we have visited on other countries is blowing back, and we have to deal with that blowback. It is no longer possible to refer, for example, to the lands of Islam without considering Britain to be one of those lands or France to be one of those lands, because Islam is extremely important and extremely influential minority faith in this religion, in this part of the world. So we cannot erect mental walls between us and other worlds, because these worlds have to a great extent fused. And so I'm not sure I agree that everything is all doom and gloom. You could argue that it has come so far, this idea of integration, that what we are witnessing now is a kind of death throw or a last gasp kind of resistance. And I think there will be, as I said earlier, an ebb and flow. I don't think, for me sitting in this room to say we can do this and it will make things better is going to... I can't think of a single thing that we need to do. We need to retain a sense of our universal humanity and retain a sense of the joy of communication between humanity. I'm very proud to be who I am. I'm very proud to be English. I'm very proud to be British. The things that make me weep tend to be the heart-stirring English things. And yet at the same time, I inhabit and joyfully inhabit a world that is fantastically diverse and fantastically integrated, and it has taught me a great deal about the universality of our shared experience, and that is what we need to find. And the limitation of introducing limits to our lives and our perspectives is not the way to grow humanity. It's the way to constrict and to kill it.
That was Christopher de Belaigue speaking to Yasmin Alibi Brown. The Islamic Enlightenment: The Modern Struggle Between Faith and Reason is out now in the UK, published by Bodley Head, and in the US, where it's published by Live Right. And you can read a version of this interview in issue 3 of BBC World Histories, which is on sale now. You can find out more details at historyextra.com. Meanwhile, the May issue of BBC History magazine has just gone on sale. In this month's edition, we have articles on the Reformation, the attack on Guernica, the historical King Arthur, and Queen Victoria's eating habits, among other things. You can get hold of the magazine in all good newsagents in the UK and internationally in our many digital formats. Outside the UK, it may still be an earlier edition that's currently in the shops. And if you'd like to take out a subscription, we currently have a great deal available for new subscribers in the UK, where you can save 35% on the shop price. You can find out more and take advantage of this offer by visiting buysubscriptions.com/HTP216.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
And now it's time for the latest history news with our website assistant, Ellie Cawthorn.
A rare handwritten manuscript of the US Declaration of Independence has been discovered in Sussex by researchers from Harvard University. The manuscript is thought to be only the second ceremonial parchment copy of the Declaration in existence. The other was produced in 1776 and is currently held in the US National Archives in Washington, D.C. The Harvard research team believes that the Sussex Declaration, which was found in a record office in Chichester, was created in the 1780s, probably in New York or Philadelphia. Professor Daniel Allen told the press, "This document was produced as part of the fight between Federalists and Anti-Federalists about whether the new republic was to be founded on the authority of a single united sovereign people or on the authority of 13 separate state governments. It appears to have been produced to support the Federalists' case. It illuminates the politics of the 1780s in a flash." In other news, a fur coat worn on the night of the Titanic disaster has sold for £150,000 at an auction in Wiltshire. The coat belonged to Mabel Bennett, a first-class stewardess who travelled on the ocean liner's doomed maiden voyage in April 1912. Bennett wore the coat for warmth as she was evacuated onto a lifeboat after the Titanic hit an iceberg. She survived the disaster and passed the coat down to a relative in the 1960s. The final sale price it achieved was almost double the original valuation of £80,000.
Just before we go, I'm pleased to announce that tickets for this year's History Weekend events are now on sale. They're taking place in Winchester from the 6th to 8th of October and York from the 24th to 26th of November. Speakers include some of the biggest names in popular history, among them Michael Wood, Dan Jones, Yanina Ramirez and Alison Weir. You can find out more details and purchase tickets at historyweekend.com. Well, that's pretty much it for this week, but please do join us next time when we'll be talking about the history of America, among other things.
Thanks for listening to this History Extra podcast, which was produced by Jack Fletcher. Do let us know what you think about this episode by emailing podcast@historyextra.com, and we might read out your messages in future editions. Alternatively, why not keep in touch via Twitter or Facebook, where you'll find us at History Extra. For more great history content, don't forget to visit our website, historyextra.com, which is full of history articles, quizzes, image galleries, and more. Plus, it's where you can download hundreds of previous episodes of this podcast.